Cut my own throat, Dibbler, stood back. Jimbo, Crash, Noddy and Scum looked at him expectantly.
"What are all the boxes for, Mr. Dibbler?" said Crash.
"Yeah," said Scum.
Dibbler carefully positioned the tenth box on its tripod.
"You boys seen an iconograph?" he said.
"Oh, yes, I mean..."
"Yeah," said Jimbo.
"They've got a little demon inside them that paints pictures of things you pointed at."
"This is like that, only for sound," said Dibbler.
Jimbo squinted past the open lid.
"Can't see any... I mean, I can't see no demon," he said.
"That's because there isn't one," said Dibbler.
It was worrying him, too. He'd have been a little happier if there'd been a demon or some sort of magic. Something simple and understandable. He didn't like the idea of meddling in science.
"Now then, suck," he began.
"The surreptitious fabric," said Jimbo.
"What?"
"The surreptitious fabric," Jimbo repeated helpfully. "It's our new name."
"Why have you changed it? You haven't been suck for 24 hours.
"Yeah, but we thought the name was holding us back."
"How could it be holding you back? You aren't moving."
Dibbler glared at them and shrugged.
"Anyway, whatever you call yourselves, I want you to sing your best song in front of these boxes. Not yet! Not yet! Wait a moment!"
Dibbler retired to the furthest corner of the room and pulled his hat down over his ears.
"All right, you can start," he said.
He stared in blissful deafness at the group for several minutes until a general cessation of movement suggested that whatever they had been perpetrating had been committed. Then he inspected the boxes. The wires were vibrating gently, but there was barely any sound. The surreptitious fabric clustered around.
"Is it working, Mr. Dibbler?" said Jimbo.
Dibbler shook his head.
"You boys don't have what it takes," he said.
"What does it take, Mr. Dibbler?"
"You got me there. You got something," he said at the sight of their dejected faces, "but not a lot of it, whatever it is."
"Does this mean we're not allowed to play at the Free Festival, does it, Mr. Dibbler?" said Crash.
"Maybe," said Dibbler, smiling benevolently.
"Thanks a lot, Mr. Dibbler."
The surreptitious fabric wandered out into the street.
"We need to get it together if we're going to wow them at the festival," said Crash.
"What, you mean like learn to play?" said Jimbo.
"No, music with Roxin just happens. If you go around learning, you never get anywhere," said Crash.
"No, I mean..." He looked around.
"Better clothes, for one thing. Did you see about them leather coats, Noddy?"
"Sort of," said Noddy.
"What do you mean, sort of?"
"Sort of leather. I went down the tannery in Phaedra Road, and they had some leather all right, but it's a bit whiffy."
"All right, we can get started on them tonight. And how about those leopard-skin trousers, Scum? You know we said leopard-skin trousers would be a great idea."
A look of transcendental worry crossed Scum's face.
"I kind of got some," he said.
"You either got them or you ain't," said Crash.
"Yeah, but they're kind of," said Scum. "Look, I couldn't find a shop that had heard of anything like that, but, you know that circus that was here last week? Only I had a word with a guy in the top hat, and, well, it was kind of a bargain, and..."
"Scum," said Crash quietly, "what have you bought?"
"Look at it this way," said Scum, with sweating brightness. "It's sort of leopard-skin trousers, and a leopard-skin shirt, and a leopard-skin hat."
"Scum," said Crash, his voice low with resigned menace, "you've bought a leopard, haven't you?"
Sort of leopardy, yes."
"Oh, good grief."
"But sort of a real steal for $20, said Scum.
"Nothing important wrong with it," the man said.
"Why do you get rid of it, then?" Crash demanded.
"It's sort of deaf. Can't hear the lion tamer," he said.
"Well, that's no good to us."
"Don't see why. Your trousers don't have to listen."
"Spare a copper, young sir."
"Push off, Grandad," said Crash easily.
"Good luck to you."
"Too many beggars around these days, my father says," said Crash as they pushed past. "He says the Beggars Guild ought to do something about it."
"But the beggars all belong to the guild," said Jimbo.
"Well, they shouldn't allow so many people to join."
"Yeah, but it's better than being on the streets."
Scum, who out of the whole group had the least amount of cerebral activity to get between him and true observation of the world, was trailing behind. He had an uneasy feeling that he'd just walked over someone's grave.
"That one looked a bit sort of thin," he muttered.
The others weren't paying any attention. They were back to the usual argument.
"I'm fed up with being surreptitious fabric," said Jimbo. "It's a silly name."
"Really, really thin," said Scum.
He felt in his pocket.
"Yeah, I liked it best when we were the Whom," said Noddy.
"But we were only the Whom for half an hour," said Crash.
A very grammatical 5 minutes, however.
"Yesterday, in between being the Blots and Lead Balloon, remember?"
Scum located a tenpenny piece and turned back.
"There's bound to be some good name," said Jimbo. "I just bet we'll know it's right as soon as we see it."
"Oh, yeah. Well, we've got to come up with some name we don't start arguing about after 5 minutes," said Crash. "It's not doing our career any good if people don't know who we are."
"Mr. Dibbler says it definitely is," said Noddy.
"Yes, but a rolling stone gathers no moss, my father says," said Crash.
"There you go, old man," said Scum back down the street.
"Thank you,"
said the grateful Death. Scum hurried to catch up with the others, who were back on the subject of leopards with hearing difficulties.
"Where did you put it, Scum?" said Crash.
"Well, you know your sort of, bedroom?" "How do you kill a leopard?" said Noddy.
"Hey, here's an idea," said Crash gloomily. "We let it choke to death on Scum."
The Raven inspected the hallway clock with the practiced eye of one who knows the value of good props. As Susan had noted, it was not so much small as dimensionally displaced. It looked small, but in the same way that something very big a long way away looks small, that is to say, the mind keeps reminding the eyes that they're wrong. But this was up close as well. It was made of some dark, age-blackened wood. There was a pendulum which oscillated slowly. The clock had no hands.
"Impressive," said the Raven. "That scythe blade on the pendulum, nice touch, very gothic. No one could look at that clock and not think, 'Squeak!' All right, I'm coming."
The Raven fluttered across to an ornamental door frame. There was a skull and bones motif on it.
"Excellent taste," it said. "Squeak, squeak."
"Well, anyone can do plumbing, I expect," said the Raven. "Interesting fact. Did you know the lavatory was actually named after Sir Charles Lavatory? Not many people know. Squeak!"
The Death of Rats pushed at the big door leading to the kitchen. It swung open with a creak, but here again there was something not quite right. A listener had the sense that the creak had been added by someone who, feeling that a door like that with a door surround like that ought to creak, had inserted one. Albert was washing up at the stone sink and staring at nothing.
"Ow,"
he said, turning.
"It's you. What's this thing?"
"I'm a raven," said the Raven nervously. "Incidentally, one of the most intelligent birds. Most people would say it's the minor bird, but..."
"Squeak!"
The Raven ruffled its feathers.
"I'm here as an interpreter," it said.
"Has he found him?"
said Albert. The Death of Rats squeaked at length.
"Looked everywhere, no sign," said the Raven.
"Then he don't want to be found,"
said Albert. He smeared the grease off a plate with a skull pattern on it.
"I don't like that."
"Squeak!" "The Rat says that's not the worst thing," said the Raven. "The Rat says you ought to know what the granddaughter has been doing."
The Rat squeaked, the Raven talked. The plate shattered on the sink.
"I knew it!"
Albert shouted.
"Saving him? She hasn't got the faintest idea. Right, I'm going to sort this out. The master thinks he can slope off, eh? Not from old Albert. You two, wait here."
There were already posters up in Pseudopolis. News travels fast, especially when C.M.O.T. Dibbler is paying for the horses.
"Hello, Pseudopolis!"
They had to call out the city watch. They had to organise a bucket chain from the river. Ashfelt had to stay outside Buddy's dressing room with a club, with a nail in it. Albert, in front of a scrap of mirror in his bedroom, brushed his hair furiously. It was white. At least, long ago it was white. Now it was the colour of a tobacco addict's index finger.
"It's my duty, that's what it is," he muttered. "Don't know where he'd be without me. Maybe he does remember the future, but he always gets it wrong. Oh, he can go on worrying about the eternal verities. But who has to sort it out when all's said and done? Muggins, that's who."
He glared at himself in the mirror.
"Right," he said.
There was a battered shoebox under the bed. Albert pulled it out very, very carefully and took the top off. It was half full of cotton wool. Nestling in the wool, like a rare egg, was a lifetimer. Engraved on it was the name Alberto Malic. The sand inside was frozen, immobile, in mid-paw. There wasn't much left in the top bulb. No time passed here. It was part of the arrangement. He worked for death and time didn't pass, except when he went into the world. There was a scrap of paper by the glass. The figures 91 had been written at the top, but lower numbers trailed down the page after it. 73, 68, 37, 19. 19. He must have been daft. He'd let his life leak away by hours and minutes, and there had been a lot more of them lately. There'd been all that business with the plumber, of course, and shopping. The master didn't like to go shopping. It was hard to get served. And Albert had taken a few holidays because it was nice to see the sun, any sun, and feel wind and rain. The master did his best, but he could never get them right. And decent vegetables, he couldn't do them properly either. They never tasted grown. 19 days left in the world. But more than enough. Albert slipped the lifetimer into his pocket, put on an overcoat, and stamped back down the stairs.
"You," he said, pointing to the death of rats, "you can't sense a trace of him. There must be something. Concentrate. Squeak. What did he say?"
"He said all he can remember is something about sand."
"Sand," said Albert. "All right. Good start. We search all the sand."
"Squeak?"
"Wherever the master is, he'll make an impression."
Cliff awoke to a swish-swish sound. The shape of Glod was outlined in the light of dawn, wielding a brush.
"What are you doing, dwarf?"
"I got asphalt to get some paint," said Glod. "These rooms are a disgrace."
Cliff raised himself on his elbows and looked around.
"What do you call the colour on the door?"
"Odenil."
"Nice."
"Thank you," said Glod. "The curtains are good too."
The door creaked open, asphalt came in with a tray, and kicked the door shut behind him.
"Oh, sorry," he said.
"I'll paint over the mark," said Glod.
Asphalt put the tray down, trembling with excitement.
"Everyone's talking about you guys," he said, "and they're saying it was about time they built a new theatre anyway. I've got you eggs and bacon, eggs and rat, eggs and coke, what was it? Oh, yes, the captain of the watch says if you're still in the city at sunrise, he will personally have you buried alive. I've got the cart all ready by the back door. Young women have been writing things on it in lipstick. Nice curtains, by the way."
All three of them looked at Buddy.
"He hasn't moved," said Glod. "Flopped down right after the show and out like a light."
"He was certainly leaping around last night," said Cliff.
Buddy continued to snore, gently.
"When we get back," said Glod, "we ought to have a nice holiday somewhere."
"That's right," said Cliff, "if we get out of this alive. I'm going to put my rock kit on my back and take a long walk. And the first time someone says to me, 'What are them things on your back?' that's when I'm going to settle down."
Asphalt peered down into the street.
"Can you all eat fast?" he said. "Only there's some men in uniform out there, with shovels."
Back in Ankh-Morpork, Mr. Cleet was astonished.
"But we hired you," he said.
"The term is retained, not hired," said Lord Downey, head of the Assassin's Guild. He looked at Cleet with an expression of unconcealed distaste.
"Unfortunately, however, we can no longer entertain your contract."
"They're musicians," said Mr. Cleet. "How hard can they be to kill?"
"My associates are somewhat reluctant to talk about it," said Lord Downey. "They seem to feel that the clients are protected in some way. Obviously, we will return the balance of your fee."
"Protected?"
muttered Cleet, as they stepped thankfully through the archway of the Assassin's Guild.
"Well, I told you what it was like in the drum when Satchelmouth began."
"That's just superstition," snapped Cleet.
He glanced up at a wall where three festival posters flaunted their primary colours.
"It was stupid of you to think assassins would be any good outside the city,"
muttered Cleet.
"Me? I never..."
"Get them more than 5 miles from a decent tailor and a mirror, and they all go to pieces,"
Cleet added. He stared at the poster.
"Free," he muttered. "Did you put it about that anyone who plays at this festival is right out of the guild?"
Yes, sir. I don't think they're worrying, sir. I mean, some of them have been getting together, sir. See, they say since there's a lot more people want to be musicians than we'll allow in the guild, then we should..."
"It's mob rule," said Cleet. "Banding together to force unacceptable rules on a defenceless city."
"Trouble is, sir," said Satchelmouth, "if there's a lot of them, if they think of talking to the palace, well, you know the patrician, sir."
Cleet nodded glumly. Any guild was powerful just so long as it self-evidently spoke for its constituency. He thought of hundreds of musicians flocking to the palace, hundreds of non-guild musicians. The patrician was a pragmatist. He never tried to fix things that worked. Things that didn't work, however, got broken. The only glimmer of hope was that they'd all be too busy messing around with music to think about the bigger picture. It had certainly worked for Cleet. Then he remembered that the blasted Dibbler man was involved. Expecting Dibbler not to think about anything concerning money was like expecting rocks not to think about gravity.
"Hello? Albert?" Susan pushed open the kitchen door.
The huge room was empty.
"Albert!"
She tried upstairs. There was her own room, and there was a corridor of doors that didn't open and possibly never could. The doors and frames had an all-in-one moulded-together look. Presumably Death had a bedroom, although proverbially Death never slept. Perhaps he just lay in bed reading. She tried the handles until she found one that turned. Death did have a bedroom. He'd got many of the details right, of course. After all, he saw quite a lot of bedrooms. In the middle of the acres of floor was a large four-poster bed, although when Susan gave it an experimental prod, it turned out that the sheets were as solid as rock. There was a full-length mirror and a wardrobe. She had a look inside just in case there was a selection of robes, but there was nothing in there except a few old shoes in the bottom. Old shoes always turn up in the bottom of every wardrobe. If a mermaid had a wardrobe, old shoes would turn up in the bottom of it. A dressing table held a jug and basin set with a motif of skulls and omegas, and a variety of bottles and other items. She picked them up one by one. Aftershave lotion, pomade, breath freshener, a pair of silver-backed hairbrushes. It was all rather sad. Death clearly had picked up an idea of what a gentleman should have on his dressing-room table without confronting one or two fundamental questions. Eventually, she found a smaller, narrower staircase.
"Albert?"
There was a door at the top.
"Albert? Anyone?"
"It's not actually barging in if I call out first," she told herself. She pushed open the door. It was a very small room, really small. It contained a few sticks of bedroom furniture and a small, narrow bed. A small bookcase contained a handful of small, uninteresting-looking books. There was a piece of ancient paper on the floor, which, when Susan picked it up, turned out to be covered with numbers, all crossed out except the last one, which was 19. One of the books was Gardening in Difficult Conditions. She went back down to the study. She'd known that there was no one in the house. There was a dead feeling in the air. There was the same feeling in the gardens. Death could create most things, except for plumbing, but he couldn't create life itself. That had to be added like yeast in bread. Without it, everything was beautifully neat and tidy, and boring, boring, boring. "This is what it must have been like," she thought, "and then one day he adopted my mother. He was curious." She took the path through to the orchard again, and when I was born, Mum and Dad were so afraid that I felt at home here, they brought me up to be, well, a Susan. What kind of name is that for Death's granddaughter? A girl like that should have better cheekbones, straight hair, and a name with V's and X's in it. And there once again was the thing he'd made for her, all by himself, working it all out from first principles. A swing. A simple swing. It was already burning hot in the desert between Klatch and Hershibba. The air shimmied, and then there was a pop. Albert appeared on a sand dune. There was a clay brick fort on the horizon.
"The Klatchian Foreign Legion," he muttered, as sand began its inexorable progress into his boots.
Albert trudged towards it, with the Death of Rats sitting on his shoulder. He knocked on the door, which had a number of arrows in it. After a while, a small hatch slid back.
"What do you want, Effendi?"
said a voice from somewhere behind it. Albert held up a card.
"Have you seen someone who didn't look like this?"
he demanded. There was a silence.
"Then, let's say, have you seen some mysterious stranger who didn't talk about his past?"
said Albert.
This is the Klatchian Foreign Legion, Effendi. People don't talk about their past. They join up
It dawned on Albert, as the pause lengthened, that it was up to him to get the conversation going again.
Forget?
Forget, yes.
So, have you had any recent recruits who were a little, shall we say, odd?
Might have done, said the voice slowly. I can't remember.
The hatchway slammed shut. Albert hammered on it again. The hatchway opened.
Yes, what is it?
Are you sure you can't remember?
Remember what?
Albert took a deep breath.
I demand to see your commanding officer.
The hatch shut. The hatch opened.
Sorry. It appears that I am the commanding officer. You're not a Dreg or a Hershibian, are you?
Don't you know?
I'm pretty sure I must have done once. You know how it is. Head like a thing. With holes in. You drain lettuce in it.
There was the sound of bolts being pulled back, and a wicket door opened in the gateway. The possible officer was a sergeant, insofar as Albert was at all familiar with Klatchian ranks. He had the look about him of someone who, among the things he couldn't remember, would include a good night's sleep, if he could remember to. There were a few other Klatchian soldiers inside the fort, sitting or just barely standing. Many were bandaged, and there was a rather greater number of soldiers slumped or lying on the packed sand, who'd never need a night's sleep ever again.
"What's been happening here?"
said Albert. His tone was so authoritative that the sergeant found himself saluting.
"We were attacked by the Dregs, sir," he said, swaying slightly. "Hundreds of them. They outnumbered us, what's the number after 9? Got a 1 in it.
10.
10-1, sir."
"I see you survived, though," said Albert.
"Ah," said the sergeant. "Yes, yes, that's where it all gets a bit complicated, in fact. Corporal, that's you. No, you just next to him. The one with the 2 stripes."
"Me?"
said a small fat soldier.
"Yes, yes. Tell him what happened."
"Oh, right. Well, the bastards had shot us full of arrows, right? And it looked like it was all up with us. Then someone suggested sticking bodies up on the battlements with their spears and crossbows and everything so the bastards would think we were still up to strength."
"It's not an original idea, mind you," said the sergeant. "It's been done dozens of times."
"Yeah,"
said the corporal awkwardly.
"That's what they must have thought. And then, when they was galloping down the sand dunes, when they was almost on us, laughing and everything, saying stuff like, 'Ha, ha, ha, that old trick again,' someone shouted, 'Fire!' And they did." "The dead men? I joined the Legion with your mind,
the corporal began.
"Forget?"
said Albert.
"That's right, forget. And I've been getting good at it. But I'm not going to forget my old mate Nadja Malik, stuck full of arrows and still giving the enemy what for,"
said the corporal. "Not for a long time. I'm going to give it a try, mind you."
Albert looked up at the battlements. They were empty.
"Someone formed them up in formation, and they all marched out afterwards," said the corporal. "And I went out to look just now, and there was just graves, and they must have dug them for one another."
tell me," said Albert, "who is this someone to whom you keep referring?"
The soldiers looked at one another.
"We've just been talking about that," said the sergeant. "We've been trying to remember. He was in the pit when it started."
"Tall, was he?"
said Albert.
"Could have been tall, eh? Could have been tall,"
nodded the corporal.
He had a tall voice, certainly."
He looked puzzled at the words coming out of his own mouth.
"What did he look like?"
"Well, he had a, with a, he was a, well, more or less, he,
did he look loud and deep?"
said Albert. The corporal grinned with relief.
"That's him," he said. Private, can't quite remember his name.
"I know that when he walked out of the sergeant began, and began to snap his fingers irritably,
the thing you open and shut, it made of wood. Hinges and bolts on it. Thank you. Gate. That's right. Gate. When he went out of the gate, he said, what was it he said, Corporal?"
"He said, 'Every last detail, sir.'"
Albert looked around the fort.
"So, he's gone."
"Who?"
"The man you were just telling me about."
Oh, yes. Have you any idea who he was, Effendi?
I mean, it was amazing. Talk about morale." "Esprit de corps," said Albert,
who could be nasty at times.
"I suppose he didn't say where he was going next."
"Where who was going next?"
said the sergeant, wrinkling his forehead in honest inquiry.
"Forget I asked," said Albert.
He took a last look round the little fort. It probably didn't matter much in the history of the world whether it survived or not, whether the dotted line on the map went one way or the other, just like the master, to tinker with things.
"Sometimes he tries to be human too," he thought, "and he makes a pig's ear out of it."
"Carry on, sergeant,"
he said, and wandered back into the desert. The legionnaires watched him disappear over the dunes, and then got on with the job of tidying up the fort.
"Who do you think he was?"
"Who?"
"The person you just mentioned."
"Did I?"
"Did you what?"
Albert crested a dune. From here the dotted line was just visible, winding treacherously across the sand.
"Squeak!" "You and me both," said Albert.
He removed an extremely grubby handkerchief from a pocket, knotted it in all four corners, and put it on his head.
"Right,"
he said, but there was a trace of uncertainty in his voice.
"Seems to me we're not going to be logical about this."
"Squeak?"
"I mean, we could be chasing him all over the place."
"Squeak?"
"So maybe we ought to think about this."
"Squeak."
"Now, if you were on the disc, definitely feeling a bit strange, and could go absolutely anywhere, anywhere at all, where would you go?"
"Squeak?"
"Anywhere at all, but somewhere where no one remembers your name."
The Death of Rats looked around at the endless, featureless, and above all dry desert.
"Squeak. You know, I think you're right."